Decentraland Podcast with David Amoyala.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for the first episode of the week of the Calcioland Podcast. Missed you guys. It's been 4 days since our last episode. We had some scheduling conflicts, but we're back. Today, we are going to focus almost exclusively on transfers, which since Serie A is on hiatus. And for the second part of the podcast, I'm pretty excited because a lot of people have asked us to talk a little bit about Serie B. We had a great review on iTunes asking us to get into the history of some clubs. So you guys know, we listen to what you guys have to say. So we're going to delve into Palermo today with my good friend Lorenzo Vicini, the past and the present of Palermo. So I think you'll enjoy that. But before we get to him and the Twitter questions, I'm joined by our great friend, Alex Goldberg. And Alex, we have a lot of stuff to talk to in the during the transfer window. A lot happens in 4 days. But I want to start with the report that Inter is set to sign Godin from Atletico Madrid. Came a little bit out of the blue. This was at the end of last week. So I have to ask you, when you first saw that report, what was your initial reaction?
Stunned and impressed, very impressed. Diego Godin, I regard as probably a top three center back in the world right now, David. Now, he doesn't necessarily get the attention as a couple other center backs, but that's because he plays at Atletico Madrid, where it feels like nobody at Atletico Madrid really gets a lot of attention because Diego Simeone has such a system. And when you're part of the system, you don't necessarily get that individual praise. But anybody that pays attention, anybody that watches Europe's top five leagues in general, know how damn good Diego Godin is. He's a damn good center back with his mentality. I feel like he has the classic center back mentality that I like, someone who's not going to take any BS from the opposition. He's gritty. He's got nails inside of him. I love that from Diego Godin. And he's just a damn good defender with a lot, David, a lot of top level experience. So you bring a player like that to Inter, whether they still have Skriniar or they don't have Skriniar, Inter are in good hands, and they really have a much more solidified foundation. Even if it was just Godin and De Vrij, that would be awesome. But you have Godin and Skriniar and De Vrij? Holy crap, that would be amazing. But nonetheless, David, my reaction to hearing that is, wow, Inter are actually ascending. Inter are slowly, maybe even quickly, coming back to where they should be. Super impressed that Diego Godin will be at Inter Milan. I have nothing else to say because honestly, it's just not a sign. It's not a signing I foresaw. The same way I never even thought I would hear Luka Modric to Inter at all in the summer. I never thought they'd get a defender at this point like Diego Godin. So I'm really impressed.
Yeah, I agree with you. And it's interesting that you first talked about the ability of the player, then a potential domino with Skriniar. So, you know, we live, especially with transfers, it's always about the future and the domino effect. And look, Godin hasn't even arrived yet. And we're already thinking, you know, what does this mean? Does this mean Simeone is coming? Does this mean Skriniar is leaving? But I'm with you. Let's just focus on the fact that Inter got one of the very best defenders in the world. Granted, he's in his early 30s out of his prime, but still someone that can compete at the highest level. And, you know, we see Juve make a lot of sexy signing, Bosman signings from outside of Serie A. They brought in Khedira and Emre Can. And it's great to see Inter, another Serie A club, be able to pull this off. So, you know, Inter had signed the previous center back from Atletico Madrid in Miranda. I think the minimum Inter fans can expect from Godin is to at least be as good as Miranda. And granted, it wasn't as good last season, but before he was one of the best center backs in Serie A. So to me, that's really the worst case scenario. I know some people brought up Vidic when he signed at Inter, but to me, this is really different. And to me, this also compared to Vidic, where it was like he's at the end of his career, he's coming to Serie A, maybe he'll do okay in Serie A because it's the league on, you know, not what it used to be. I think Godin, on the other hand, is a sign that Serie A and Inter are really attractive destinations. So now let's talk about the potential dominoes. Now, you mentioned Skriniar, and it's interesting because Inter haven't been able to extend his contract. And maybe it's also because of their financial fair play issues. Maybe they'd rather increase his salary once they're out of the woodwork for that. But I think it really puts them in a position of strength because, as you mentioned, they also have DeVry. And if you have DeVry and Godin, that's pretty damn good. But you have all three of them together, to me, I almost think that's better than the BBC that Juve had, at least on paper, for that. So it really gives Inter a lot of options. Kudos to them. But, you know, with Bosman signings, there are always some domino effects. Like, I was reading that Skriniar is already asking to be paid like De Vrij, who arrived last summer. So always remember, these transfers aren't free. But great job by Inter. Let's not focus so much on Skriniar, although the Simeone aspect might be quite interesting. I think, if anything, it makes it Inter even more attractive. It's a club that he has ties to already. So I'm going to focus on the positive and say this is an absolute home run for Inter. And one thing that's always a home run are the questions from our Twitter listeners, Twitter followers, and our listeners. We're going to go over quite a few of these. Almost all of them are related to transfers. We have a great music one at the end. And which ones are we going to go over today, Alex?
All right, David, let's start off with this one. What are your thoughts on the Italian Super Cup taking place in Saudi Arabia?
So this had been planned, you know, before the last incidents in Serie A. And what I like to say is I thought Serie A was on a great streak for a while. The Ronaldo arriving, Roma making the CL semifinal, a fantastic title race. Like 2018, in a lot of ways, was a banner year for Serie A. Then we had the Koulibaly incidents. Then we had the VAR not being what it used to be. So Serie A was kind of some negative momentum. And now this thing of the Super Cup taking place in Saudi Arabia was added to it. Now this had already been decided a while back, but it came at the forefront now that Serie A is out. So I think this brings even more negative momentum to the league. You know, a lot was made on when the tickets were released. You know, women weren't allowed and all the good seats. Serie A tried to put a positive, Serie A's management tried to put a positive spin on saying, well, hey, this is the first sporting event where at least women can go. But, you know, you always follow the money and decisions are made for money. It's definitely not a good look for Serie A. I'm going to chalk it up to its unfortunate timing after the Koulibaly and the VAR incident that it happened this way. But I think Serie A really needs to get back to some positive momentum after this takes place.
All right, David. Next Twitter question. Now that the deal seems all but done, what are your thoughts on Aaron Ramsey joining Juventus?
So I wrote about this on Sunday for our friends at Euro Fantasy Game. I've been thinking a lot about it. And what I think happens a lot of times is, you know, just because a deal is good and we're like, yeah, it's a good deal. Juve gets this midfielder. They could use more quality midfielders. He was linked to top clubs. It's great that Juve beat out PSG for him. But I have to ask myself, is this really a great deal for Juve? Because to me, and this is something both Marotta and Paratici, and Paratici has been saying it recently, it's very hard to improve a team like Juve. I think Ronaldo, obviously, was a clear improvement. You get one of the two best players in the world to come to the team. That raises the bar. You know, I have to ask myself, Ramsey, if he's coming in to be a starter, and he's certainly getting paid like a starter, he's going to be making as much money as Dybala, that's going to have a domino effect on the team. So I have to ask myself, you know, would Ramsey start for the teams that Juve is competing against for the Champions League? Because that's really now the bar for Juve. Like, I learned this in the summer that Milan was buying all these players. Like, I was one of the people cheerleading, say, hey, great job. These are all great moves, because I was looking at it in a very narrow lens. I was telling myself, okay, these are upgrades over what Milan had before. But the question is if you want to take the next step as a club, you have to get players that are good enough to start for the teams that are ahead of you. So if Ramsey's coming to be a super sub, great. I have a hard time believing that he would accept that, and especially being paid like that, because that's going to come at a cost. Emre Can arrived, very big salary. Pjanic and Sami Khedira got raises right after. There's going to be a domino effect for this. So I think it's a good deal for Juve, but I have to ask myself if this is the right deal for Juve.
Good point there, David. And My thing with Aaron Ramsey is when he's on the pitch and he's feeling comfortable and his teammates are playing well with him, he's a really good midfielder. Key part there, when he's on the pitch, he has struggled with injuries for a lot of his career. Let's see if Juve actually get the return they want, because I'm not sure he's always going to be healthy. So next Twitter question, what is the dynamic between Leonardo and Gatsidis when it comes to Milan's transfers?
So when I got this question, I had a flashback to a few years ago when Dybala was at Palermo and we were covering all the teams interested in him when he was at Palermo. And one of the teams was Arsenal. And we had a report on Di Marzio's site that Gatsidis was involved with this transfer. And I got such a huge reaction from Arsenal fans saying, well, that report has to be BS because Gatsidis is not involved with player acquisitions. And I get the vibe that really Gatsidis is there much more for the commercial aspects and help Milan with financial fair play. So not only get more sponsors and increase the revenues, but also work with UEFA. I think Leonardo is really the one that's in charge of transfers. Maldini is working with him side by side on that aspect more than anything else. So I really see Gatsidis as the business guy and Leonardo and Mancini being involved with the transfers.
All right. I've seen this player be talked about a lot on Twitter lately. What's the latest on Yannick Ferreira Carrasco?
So he's one of those players that went to China probably too young, followed the money, makes an enormous salary. The Chinese club that acquired him invested a lot. He also in a transfer fee to get him. And he has the itch to return to Europe. So I know Arsenal fans been asking me a ton about him. So let me just answer it this way. Milan was interested, and they still are. The problem is they can only acquire him on loan, probably with an option to buy, not a forced one. And they would need Carrasco to take a pay cut. He earns 10 million net, so an enormous salary. To give you a perspective, that's more than Higuain right now. So I think Arsenal's in a much better position to fit those parameters. I'm not that familiar with their team, but it sounds like he fits a position of need there. I've seen plenty of other sites report Arsenal's interest. So I think it's more likely in the Premier League than in Serie A, because I know Milan would love to have him. It seems he'd be interested in going to Milan, but the finances look to be the issue at this time.
All right, David, what are your thoughts on Kostas Manolas potentially joining Manchester United?
So we talked about it a little bit, I think, in a previous episode. So there was a ton of buzz on Mino Raiola becoming his agent. And as we mentioned last time, Man United fans got excited because they've done a ton of business with Mino Raiola. And maybe the deals haven't worked out that great. But Manolas, I think, would fit really, really well. I don't think he's in the elite echelon of center backs in Serie A. I definitely put him a notch below the Koulibaly, the Skriniars, and the Chiellinis of the world, but he's right below it. But Raiola's been working with Manolas for a while. He was in the intermediary in the deal to bring him to Roma from Greece. So I wouldn't read too much into that, but I could see Manolas leaving at the end of the season. And this is the key, at the end of the season, because he does have an exit clause, very reasonable, $36 million. But that one's just valid in the summer. So you can't use it now in January. But Manchester United planting the seed now really helps, because they can offer him a huge salary. Roma's trying to negotiate a new deal where either they raise that exit clause or they get rid of it altogether. But if Man United, tells Raiola, we're going to give him a huge salary, it's going to be hard for Roma to get it done. So my guess is it won't be in January. Roma really needs him to make the Champions League, finish in the top four. Roma needs the revenue that comes with that. They've been playing a lot better recently. But I wouldn't really be surprised if Raiola is really planting the seed and preparing this transfer in the summer.
All right. Here's an interesting one. Do you think Spalletti should still be coaching Inter? Why doesn't he play Lautaro Martinez and Icardi together?
Yeah, so for me, it's really simple. As I always say, easy to sack the manager, much harder to find someone better. So look, if Diego Godin helps bring in Simeone, great. That's a no-brainer. If Conte wants to follow Marotta to Inter, great. Now, I think people forget that Marotta and Conte actually didn't really get along at the end at Juve. I mean, one of the main reasons Conte left is because he clashed with Marotta on transfers a lot. When Conte left Juve, he thanked everyone except for Marotta and Paratici. But look, Inter is a job that I think would be very attractive to Conte. So I think Spalletti is going to finish the season, rightfully so. And then after that, we'll have to see if Inter can attract a bigger name. Now, if you listen to the quotes that Spalletti has on Lautaro Martinez, he talks about him as strictly a center forward, and he likes to play with two wingers next to a center forward. He hasn't really often played with two strikers. So I know a lot of people, and Lautaro Martinez and his dad, would love to see him play with Icardi. But I think he's going to be more of a super sub the rest of the season. Let's see if that role's enough for him. Maybe, you know, when a new coach comes in, he'll have more opportunities. But my guess is Spalletti finishes the season. Inter's goal is to go back to the Champions League, finish in the top four. They're in very good shape for that right now, so I don't see an imminent change.
All right, David, the next Twitter question is definitely from a Chelsea fan. What's the latest on Gonzalo Higuain, and is Icardi a realistic alternative?
So let's start with Icardi, and that's funny that you knew who this came from. And right today, before we record, is a lot of buzz on Icardi's wife and agent, Wanda Nara, making a lot of statements that Inter isn't close to offering him the salary that they want, and that there's interest from the two biggest clubs in Spain and some in the Premier League. And look, you know, public statements on these, this is really a negotiation ploy. Wanda, I think she gets a bad rap because agents do this all the time. I think it's because she's the wife and she's a female. And, you know, she's quite attractive and not afraid to flaunt it. I think she really gets a bad rap, but this is agents 101. She's trying to create leverage. And I think, you know, and you also look, Icardi is, I think, the 10th highest paid player in Serie A. I would say he has to be at least in the top five for sure. So I think she absolutely has a point on having him with a higher salary, and I think Inter knows this as well. Now, there's also the exit clause, and just like Manolas, this exit clause is not valid in January. It's actually valid only for a certain amount of time during the summer transfer window. I know some Inter fans tweeted me, oh, you forget that the clause expired last summer. It's like, guys, it's valid every summer in the contract for, I think, from July 1st. Don't call him it anyway. There's a window of time. So nobody could exert the exit clause now. There's no chance Icardi's leaving in January. I still think at the end of the day, they are going to reach an agreement. He'll probably get Dybala money, around $7 million season net. And I think that's at least what he should be paid for. And I think all this is just noise, would be my guess. Now on Higuain, this is a very complicated deal. And I know there are some sites in Spain and England that are having this as a done deal. That's not the case as far as I know. Sarri's really pushing to have Higuain. You know, Alex, better than I, Chelsea doesn't like to invest a lot and give huge multi-year deals to players over 30. So I think this is much more on Sarri's side. But that's not the only complication. There are two other factors on this. Juve owns Higuain. They can't have him come back to the team next season because of his huge salary and amortized value. They need to make sure he's off. He's not coming back. So I think if the deal happens, Juve is going to want some guarantees that whoever acquires him, if he moves in January, is going to commit to keeping him next season. So that's already a hurdle. The other hurdle is Milan would have to agree to let him leave. This isn't like in FIFA that you can just recall the loan, pay a fee, and be done with it. Like, Milan invested $18 million just to have Higuain on loan. So if they let him go, A, they're going to want a replacement because they need a striker to try to finish in the top four. And they're going to want compensation for that $18 million that they paid. So the more I think about it, the more I think this deal is really rather complicated. It would somewhat surprise me if it happens in January.
Honestly, being a Chelsea fan right now in the January transfer market is so damaging to my health, it's not even funny. But let's continue with that, shall we? Because I assume this is also from a Chelsea fan, but could be from another fan because this player is linked to a couple clubs. David, what's the latest on Nicolò Barella?
So yeah, I'm going to wrap up that Higuain thing for saying by saying that the good news, if you wanted Higuain at Chelsea, is that I'm a big believer of where there's a will, there's a way. And I think Higuain would be fine leaving Milan. Leonardo actually threw him under the bus yesterday in a press conference, which was really rather surprising, saying he needs to take responsibility. And if he's not sure if he wants to be here, which was really quite surprising. So maybe Milan wouldn't be that upset to offload him. And I think Juve wants a guarantee that someone's going to pay him next season. So I don't want to completely put that off the table. Now, Barella is another one where a lot of sites are reporting this as an imminent deal for Chelsea. And I did some digging on this. As far as I know, that's not the case. This, again, it seems Sarri is more interested in Barella. And I think he'd be quite similar to what Allan provided for him at Napoli. It's interesting that one of my Twitter followers actually brought a very interesting comparison, Barella for Vidal at Juve. And I could see that a little bit. I'm not saying he's nearly as good as that, but that's that style of box-to-box dynamic player that can break through the lines between the midfield and attack. I actually think if I had to guess, there's a better chance that Napoli is going to get Barella. And the domino effect is Allan of all players, because PSG is interested in him. They have yet to make an offer. PSG does have some big financial fair play issues, but PSG were really impressed with Allan when they faced them in the Champions League. His match when they played in Paris, he was really unbelievable that match. And I saw, you know, we've had this on Di Marzio's site as a possibility. I saw Auremma, who's one of the most plugged in people in Napoli, very close to the team today. He had a report saying that this could happen. So I think if I had to bet, odds are I think Barella finishes the season at Cagliari. But if he moves, I would say Napoli with Allan going to PSG slightly more likely than Chelsea. But let's see what happens. I'm not going to exclude Chelsea again because Sarri is there, and I think he would fit that team pretty well. I know a lot of people have said, what does that say about Kante? And I think Barella is so versatile that that wouldn't be a problem. He would be able to play with him. Now, is he a completely natural substitute for Fabregas? No, he's a different type a midfielder, but he's definitely a quality player that could fill the minutes that Fabregas was giving, but maybe in a different way.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned a direct replacement for Fabregas, because that's what Sarri keeps saying, because if Fabregas is leaving, then obviously they need someone to replace him. But I think what people are misunderstanding is Sarri isn't saying he wants a clone of Fabregas. Cesc is very special. He's a very good passer, and he's almost a one-trick pony as well. So he doesn't mean that he wants a clone or a direct replacement for Fabregas's qualities. He wants a replacement, a.k.a. a backup to Jorginho for those minutes, not to just clone Fabregas and have a similar type player. And then on Barella, I really like him, David, because most of all, I love his mentality. He's kind of fearless. He's got grit. He's a hard worker. And after the Alvaro Morata saga, where you can really see what a poor mentality doesn't do in the Premier League, and Maurizio Sarri constantly questioning Chelsea's mentality after draws or losses, Barella feels like he would be a good fit from a mentality standpoint. Feels like he's not really afraid of anything. All right, David, staying on Barella, would Barella joining Chelsea and playing with Jorginho be a good development for the Italian national team?
Absolutely. No brainer. And it's not just playing with Jorginho. I think any midfielder that plays for Sarri, that's like going to university. Great teacher. You know, I'm kind of happy. I mean, I know for you it's harder, Alex, because I'm sure you would have preferred that Sarri's honeymoon never end. But I have to say, both you and I were really pretty spot on with what Sarri was going to bring to Chelsea. But I think what you can't take away is he is a great maestro di calcio, as we would say in Italy. So yeah, this would be great for Mancini. I'm sure Mancini is really rooting for this deal to happen for Chelsea. Now, Alex, speaking of Jorginho, one of our listeners has a question for you. And he said, Alex, I saw this tweet, and the tweet says that Jorginho is the first player to give 1,896 league passes without registering an assist. So my first reaction was like, was there someone that had 1,995 and that was the Watershed Mark, or this is like a whole new record. But aside from that, you've been watching Jorginho, you watch them at Napoli, you've been watching them at Chelsea. What do you think this stat ultimately says about him?
Well, it's misleading. First off, it's misleading. Whether he's playing really well or not well at all, it's definitely misleading. And David, I would say that right now, Jorginho is the player that is splitting the Chelsea fan base. There's obviously some players that Chelsea fans love and then really don't love. But Jorginho, it seems like it's split right down the middle. And I think most of that is because Chelsea fans don't really understand what Jorginho does, because the whole team right now is still not playing as fluid as obviously last year's Napoli. And it's not like Sarri ball is happening for 90 minutes every game. Jorginho is taking a lot of criticism that I think is unfair. Jorginho obviously knows the system better than any other player on the pitch, but if the players around him don't know it as well, because Jorginho is the metronome and he is the nucleus in the middle of the pitch, it makes him look worse, or it makes him look very simplistic. Yes, he does do a lot of sideways passing, so that obviously caters to that stat. He does a lot of sideways passing, but that's what Sarri wants from him. He wants it to move it quickly from side to side so he can catch the defense out of position, so he can catch the defense not in the right position. This is what Jorginho does. He plays really far deep. He's not in many goal scoring or goal assisting opportunities. However, David, he does provide a hockey assist, the assist to the assist. So that's very important. If he is in the middle of buildup plays that actually score goals, well, then get out of here with your assists and get out of here with your goals. He's very, very important. Now, with all that said, he still hasn't been amazing, but once again, I think that's because he will be better. He will look better when the players around him start learning the system better. I'm not cutting excuses for him. I'm just telling you what I think and why I think people are getting a little too critical of Jorginho. So that's that to me. Doesn't mean a whole lot.
You stole my thunder, Alex. Well said. The hockey assist to me, Jorginho, is the master of that. And actually, we have a somewhat breaking news as we're recording. There's a report from Di Marzio that Inter and Icardi's wife agent, Wanda Nara, are going to have a meeting to discuss the extension. So I'm not surprised. I always said the public quotes. I really didn't read too much into it. So it looks like there's going to be more momentum for that. So sorry to interrupt you, but I wanted to share that with our listeners.
No worries. That's very important information. All right, David, next Twitter question. What would Leandro Paredes bring to Chelsea?
So that's the other player that's been linked to Chelsea. And look, I don't want to make it sound, because I've had some people, people ask me about Paredes, and I've never been a fan. And I saw some people say, oh, you're just trying to push Chelsea to sign Barella instead. And I'm like, A, I wish I had that sort of pull, which clubs, which I don't. But B, if you really wanted to take it deeper, you could search my TL dating back to when Paredes played for Roma. I never was a huge fan. I actually think he is the definition of a Vine player. He looks great in some moments and some quick videos, but maybe not so much in a match. Now, the flip side to that argument is, A, I haven't watched him play in Russia, and Juve's sporting director Paratici, who knows a hell of a lot more about football and midfielders than I do, is a fan. So maybe it'd be a good addition. Now, I'll tell you, between him and Barella, he's definitely a lot closer to Fabregas' style of play. So maybe he'd be a more natural fit. Would he excite you for Chelsea or not really, Alex?
I'm more into Barella. I really am. I think Barella has everything I'm looking for in a Sarri midfielder. Paredes, take them or leave them. Honestly, there are youth players in Chelsea's system that I think could be much better fits than Paredes. So I'm not as into him. No. So, David, next Twitter question. We're moving away from Chelsea now, Calcio fans. Napoli have been linked to Spal's Lazzari. How good is he and how would he fit at Napoli?
Hey, and by the way, guys, we answer the question you guys sent us. And look, you know, obviously Alex has a lot of following with Chelsea. But send them in. We'll be happy to answer other questions. And we do get a lot of questions on Lazzari. And I get a lot of questions from these from the guys with, like, the football index, which seems real. Like, I don't know. Maybe I should get into it, because I have a feeling I might be able to make some money with that. But that aside, we got a lot of questions on Lazzari, one of the most up-and-coming, the best up-and-coming players in Serie A. In our winners and losers segment, he has to be one of the players we mentioned as a winner most often this season. Now, he's been linked to Napoli because his age is potentially on his way out. And Lazzari is an intriguing player. I like him. And to me, though, he strikes me as a right wing back who's much better in a 3-5-2, playing maybe a little bit more of an offensive style. I think he's one of the leaders in Serie A in crossing. I'm not so sure he could really be a right back in a more traditional four-man defense. But I think Ancelotti could figure it out. So I could see him at Napoli. I think he's going to finish the season at Spal. They need him to avoid relegation, but I'm pretty curious to see what would happen. And I think he will be playing for a top team. Actually, I'm rather certain he'll be playing for a team other than Spal next season and likely going to be a top team in Serie A.
All right, David, next question. If you could have a bottle of Barolo with a Serie A manager, who would it be and why?
Great question. And actually, the same tie into the previous question. I think it would have to be Ancelotti, who knows a lot about wines. Him and Pirlo are very close, like to enjoy wine. So I'm sure he would know a lot of this. Now, Ancelotti, you know, is from Emilia-Romagna, more northern Italy. You know, I have a feeling he's more into those wines. Barolo is from Piemonte, the region where Juve is from. But I have to say, it'd be pretty intriguing. I bet you Ancelotti, now that he's really embraced the city of Napoli, I have a feeling he's been getting into the southern Italian wines, and they have very good wine from the region around Napoli called Aglianico. So maybe I'd have him pull out a really good Aglianico, because those wines are pretty intriguing too.
Last Twitter question. What's the best opening song on an album? Not necessarily a hit, but one that steps up the album to be great.
This is actually one of the best questions we got in a while. Joseph Baccaglieri, thank you for this question. You know, what I love, you know, I love getting feedback from you guys that you listen to us, you know, at work, during your commute, at the gym. Like, I'm humbled that Alex and I are part of your lives like this. But, you know, when a listener sends me a question like this, like, I don't half-ass it. I go on a big deep dive and start really thinking about this. So I put a lot of thought into it, and I'm going to give you quite a few answers. It won't take too long, but I think you'll enjoy it. So as we're recording this, and I should specify, we're recording this on Wednesday around 1 p.m. Boston time. So if some of the transfer stuff changes, just keep in mind this is when we're recording. And today happens to be Page's birthday, and he's the guitar player in Led Zeppelin. So as a tribute to him, I'm going to put Whole Lot of Love as a great song that sets up an album. Because that song is pretty sexual, and I would say Zeppelin 2 is one of the most sexual albums out there. So I think it sets it up perfectly. So staying on older bands, I'm going to put the first song on the Beatles album, Revolver, Taxman, on this list, because that's really when the Beatles changed. Maybe some of our listeners aren't that familiar. Like, when the Beatles first came out, they were somewhat the equivalent of a boy band in our ages, and they just became, you know, much better musicians. They obviously, Lennon and McCartney crafted their songwriting skills, and Taxman is actually Harrison's song. But that was really the beginning of the big change for the Beatles. So I'm going to put that. For Pink Floyd, I have two. The opening track on Dark Side of the Moon, there's a brief intro, but Breathe really sets up that album for being psychedelic, really a headphone album by definition. Another great opening track for Pink Floyd is In the Flesh, the opening track on The Wall. Interestingly, when Roger Waters does tours, it's usually one of these two songs is the first song that he plays. Staying in the 70s, and our friend Michael Lisi responded to this question and put a great one. Van Halen, the first song on Van Halen 1, Running with the Devil. To me, great introduction to Van Halen. Eddie Van Halen is the first modern guitar hero, in my opinion. Like Jimmy Page, whose birthday today, the king of the riffs, and, you know, kind of a guitar hero. But to me, Eddie Van Halen really is the definition of that. And you really got a sense of that with Running with the Devil, which is followed by Eruption, which is one of his probably most famous solos. And so that, I'm going to put it there. Now we're going to move to the 80s. And this one fits well because it's not really a hit, but really sets up the album perfectly. And this is the first song on The Cure's plain song, the opening track. I forget always the name of the album. Let me look it up briefly. Disintegration, the most famous Cure album. I think that sets up the album great. Usually when the Cure play a live show, this is the first song as well. So I'm going to stay on the 80s, but move to metal. And three songs, opening tracks on albums that I think are great setups. Battery, first song on Master of Puppets, really gives you an idea of what the album's going to be like. Slayer's Angel of Death, first song on their most famous album. Really, to me, probably the best definition of a thrash metal, that's the song. From Megadeth, I'm going to have Holy Wars. Really a fantastic song, sets up Rust in Peace. Really gives you a sense. This is really the apex of Megadeth. Their best lineup was with Marty Friedman and Menza, and on that album, you really hear it well. I mean, the last one from the 80s that I'm going to put is Welcome to the Jungle, because I think the opening track on Appetite for Destruction really sets up that album really well. In a lot of ways, it was the end of hair metal. Guns N' Roses kind of looked a little bit like a hair metal band a little bit at first, but then you hear this song and what they're talking about, and that whole album is really about the seedy underworld in LA in a lot of ways, and sets it up really well. So let's move to the 90s, and I'm going to start with a rap song, and I'm going to go with GZA's Liquid Swords. I'll never forget like hearing that song for the first time. That's probably my favorite rap album, and I think that sets it up perfectly. In the 90s, and this one wasn't a completely obvious one at first, but I was really thinking about it, and it has to be Smells Like Teen Spirit on Nirvana's album, Nevermind. I think that song, kind of like how Welcome to the Jungle started the end of hair metal, like that was really the beginning of grunge. And the last two that I have are Radiohead. I was going to say Airbag at first, the first song on OK Computer, because kind of like Liquid Swords, when I first heard it, I was like, man, this band is really on a whole other level. And I think OK Computer is probably their best album. And I think Airbag, you really can tell like Radiohead just went to a whole other level there. But I think even more importantly, the most important first song on an album for them is Everything in Its Right Place, the first song off Kid A, because that's when Radiohead moved away from being a guitar band and just opened a whole other phase of their career. To me, they became the only band that matters in this modern era because they completely changed their style. Every album was completely different than the one before, and this is where it started. Speaking of the only band that matters, I'm going to say another great opening song, and this is a much older album, The Clash's London Calling, and they had the moniker as the only band that matters back in the 70s. And I'm going to close it as the last song that I'm going to pick, and yesterday was his birthday, David Bowie. Unfortunately, he left us a few years ago, and I'm going to pick the first song of his last album, Black Star. Bowie, absolute genius. He knew he was dying. He went out on top. He did an album that was really his swan song, and that song, it gives me goosebumps every time I hear it. So that's my pick. So thank you, Joseph, for this question. I think you guys could tell that I really enjoyed answering it. Bear with me. I was a little bit shaky remembering the albums because I'm suffering the effects. I took some NyQuil last night, and I just don't feel like myself. And this is a perfect segue to talk about the CBD oil. To me, a great, great product that we've been talking on the podcast. Like, I really hate regular medicine, and I was, like, really sick. Last night, I was trying to get a good night's sleep. Took NyQuil, knocked me out all day. I felt like really groggy. And I was like, you know what? I should have just taken some CBD because that stuff really works. Last week, I was telling you guys about that I turned on someone that I work with at my day job, someone that's older than me that was having shoulder problems. I gave him the oil and it was miraculous. He feels so much better. And interestingly, since then, I've had three other colleagues come up to me and ask me if I could give them some CBD oil. So I guess news travels fast. So I know, Alex, you also really enjoyed the CBD oil. Can you tell our listeners how you use it and the product specifically that we're endorsing?
Yeah, absolutely. I haven't fully even talked about the three products I use from BioCBD Plus. So the three products are total body care capsules, which of course are CBD capsules that really have a very effective and quickly effective work rate on you. Work rate. I'm tying in football. That's great. And then the topical muscle and joint oil. That's the CBD oil, David, that you speak of, that your colleague had a shoulder problem with, put it on and relief. I've had that with headaches. Now I've had it with body aches. It really does work instantly. And then, of course, their pen that comes with in a little rectangular box. It's the pen, it's a vape cartridge, and a charger. It is so damn easy to use. You don't have to be a technical expert or really know what you're doing. It is so simple and easy to use. And I just really want to stress once again that all three of these products, all of their products, are 100% free. This is very important. 100% free of harmful chemical fillers. No artificial flavoring, no nicotine or THC, no isolate or crystalline CBD, non-GMO, eco-friendly CO2 extraction. I'm saying all that because it really is important nowadays. So you are just making your body healthier and you're really giving yourself some much needed relief. Helps with pain, anxiety, inflammation, sleep, nausea. Who doesn't need help with those things? And where can you find these products? Well, at BioCBDPlus.com, our friends at BioCBDPlus.com. And if you use our discount code, CALCHOLAND15, all lowercase, CALCHOLAND15, you'll get 15% off all of their products. As David and I keep saying, we use it and we love it.
So now let's introduce the interview segment of the podcast. So this came actually as a suggestion on one of the reviews that someone left on iTunes. So if you haven't already left us a review, it really helps us grow. And I'll almost always take any feedback you take there. So someone asked us to get into the history of some maybe minor clubs in Serie A. And Palermo's been in Serie B. They've been in Serie A. Very interesting club's history, both past and present. So I brought in my friend Lorenzo Vicini. So I think you'll really enjoy this interview. It's a little bit different than what we usually do on CalcioLand. So I look forward to chatting with you guys. We'll do another episode in a few days. If you dig what you hear, as usual, share this with your Twitter followers, leave us a review, and we really appreciate it. Okay. And for the interview part of the podcast, today really is a treat for me because, you know, what I've really enjoyed about the podcast, the interview typically is my favorite segment because either I get to talk with journalists that I really like, that I can learn from. And in a lot of cases, I can talk to people that I've known for a long time via Twitter. And today happens to be the case. I'm joined by Lorenzo Vicini, who runs the outstanding Ultra Palermo website and Twitter account. So we're going to talk about Palermo and Serie B. But the reason I'm excited is I've known Lorenzo via Twitter for a long time, I think at least 4 or 5 years. But we've never actually spoken until today, and we were getting ready. I got a lot of cool stories about his roots to Sicily. So today I figured Palermo is a great topic because a lot of you guys have been asking us to cover Serie B. And this season I was thinking about doing it because my hometown Padova made it back to Serie B, but we're currently in last place. So I try to always highlight the positive in calcio, but Palermo is actually doing great. In addition to how well they're doing in the standings, the club was recently sold. Zamparini has a very interesting legacy. I know even those who aren't calcio junkies, you know about Zamparini's sacking, but he also, Palermo really brought a lot of great talents to Italy. So there's really nobody better to discuss this stuff with than my good friend Lorenzo Vicini. So, Zoe, after that really long intro, welcome to CalcioLand. It's a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thanks, David. It's great to finally be able to chat, not only with you, but to be able to talk about my beloved Rossanero. So let's get to it.
Awesome. Okay. So I'll tell you what, let's start with the past because it's pretty intriguing and that's what most of our listeners are into. And then we're going to talk about the present of Palermo, which for someone like you who covers the club, I know is very exciting right now. So Zamparini was known as someone who really sacked managers at a really incredible rate. Serie A and Calcio in general are known for managerial sackings, but there was really no one quite Zamparini. And if anyone goes to your Twitter page, which is @VicciniLo, there is a great picture on Palermo coaches on the Zamparini. And I don't want to make a Trump joke, but you can see it there. So tell me, Lorenzo, what was your favorite managerial sacking of the Zamparini era?
Yeah, so just to set the tone here, for those people who might not know the quirkiness of Maurizio Zamparini, David said it correctly. He was known as a coach eater, essentially. And when he took over the club in 2002, he bought Palermo when they were in Serie B. And up until a month ago, I would say, in 2018. So you're looking at a span of, 16, 17 years at the helm of the club. He went through 45 different coaching appointments, including hirings and firings. And every single one of them could almost be as unique as any of the others. So one of my favorite, I'll give you two. One of my favorite sackings goes way back into the 2011 season, where Palermo was just coming off of losing in the Coppa Italia final to Inter, and they were really riding high. They had a good nucleus together, but Delio Rossi, who brought the club to some very significant heights, was let go due to some disagreements with Zamparini. There could have also been some jealousy on Zamparini's part because Delio Rossi was really beloved by the fans. Needless to say, Zamparini, heading into the new season, brought in Stefano Pioli. Pioli came in and he joined the club in June, started with taking over the training camp for the club, getting the players ready. And by August 31st, before Serie A had even begun, he was sacked. And Stefano Pioli is one of two managers under Zamparini who never officially coached a Serie A match while being listed as the Palermo coach. The difference here is that really Zamparini really rued this sacking, because Pioli went on to have good success. And this is where the infamous Zamparini quote about eating his own testicle, because of how upset he was for his own fault in firing Stefano Pioli. The second one would go back just a couple years ago, and it's incredible to think how chaotic the 2016 season was. But at one point, Palermo easily had more coaching appointments than wins. But Zamparini went outside of his normal scope, and for the first time, he brought in a coach who was not Italian. His name was Guillermo Barros Scalotto, and fans of international football should recognize him because he just recently managed a very testy final between River and his Boca Juniors. But he was named as the Palermo coach, and yet he lasted just a month, and he never officially was actually able to sit on the bench because he did not have the proper UEFA coaching license. So in the meantime, while he was sitting there leading trainings, Palermo had a round robin of coaches on the bench between Fabio Viviani, Giovanni Bossi, who was the youth team coach at one point, and even Giovanni Tedesco, who longtime Rosanero fans will remember as being a local talent that played with the club in the early 2000s. So those are just two of the 45 different sackings. Sadly, David, I think I've told you this before, and others who know me might know, but I have a very detailed spreadsheet that lists out every single detail for every single one of these coaches, from the total consecutive days that they were at the helm of the club, the total cumulative days, because let's not kid ourselves here. Zamparini has gone back to the well with numerous managers several times over. So basically, you know, I have a problem in that I'm a glutton for punishment here with all the different details that I have for that chaotic time under Zampadini.
Well said. So as I mentioned, you know, Zampadini is mainly known for this, but do you think the fact that, as you mentioned, over 40 sacking, someone very colorful manner, do you think that overshadows too much also his ability with his scouting network to bring so many good talented players to Italy from abroad?
It definitely hampered, I think, some of the Zampadini's goal was always to make it to the Champions League. And that's not something that isn't well known. It was very well known. And in fact, back when he had a very good nucleus around him, the only thing in my mind that really did stop the club from reaching that Champions League was Zampadini himself. You can't have consistency from the player's point of view or even the regular running of a club if you continually are switching things up, and often to a very negative effect. There's another funny story about that. I think it was in 2016 when Palermo was on the brink of being relegated. Zampadini every other week was changing coaches, and it was a very chaotic time. And through some contacts, I wrote him an email, not expecting to ever get a response. And because Zampadini is as unique as he is, 3 days later, sure enough, I got a response from the president, owner of Palermo Calcio, why he was taking the time to write to me from his iPad in the wee hours of the morning. I'll never know, but that is a lovely anecdote. And I know others who know about this story, I've teased the fact that I will release this email because it is quite funny, riddled full of outlandish comparisons between players that were under the club's ownership to guys like Ibrahimovic and some other famous Roma players. But I'm holding on to it because this is a good segue. The new ownership structure under Palermo isn't 100% solidified yet, but I just want to make sure Zampadini is completely out of the picture, even though he is right now. You can never be too sure.
Yeah. Before we get to the new owners, because I want to ask you about this, and this is how our conversation a few weeks ago started when that happens. Before we get to those, let me ask you, what are some of the most famous players that Zampadini brought to Palermo? Because I think a lot of these names are very familiar now to people that listen to the podcast, but maybe they don't realize that they arrived to Italy through Palermo.
Absolutely. That's a good idea here. So if you think way back, I think one of the first names that really took off, and he did very well for Palermo and the Rosanero, but he really exploded at his second club, and now he's a worldwide name, would be Edinson Cavani. Cavani got his start under Palermo, and really, like I said, was a very good player. Now, there was some inconsistency in his finishing, etc., but when Palermo sold him to Napoli, and Napoli were really the only ones serious enough to buy him, that's where he really took off. Beyond Cavani, you had Javier Pastore, who joined the club at the height of its glory under Zampadini. More current names, Paolo Dybala was Palermo jewel. In fact, it's crazy, but both Paolo Dybala and Franco Vazquez both were under were both at Palermo, yes, when they were in Serie A, but also when they were in Serie B. And that was in the 2013-2014 season where the club set records in Serie B for points accumulated in a season. And if you think about those two, I know Vazquez is now at Sevilla, obviously Dybala at Juventus, they're doing a tremendous job. You pair them up with a guy that wasn't from outside of Italy, but definitely was unknown until Palermo purchased him. Andrea Belotti, he's another name that really took off under Palermo. Then we sold him to Torino, and now he's a regular part of the Italian national team. Some other lesser-known players that Zamparini brought into Italy, though, are guys like Josip Iličić, who I know is a favorite of yours, David, as you talked about. Kamil Glik, the defender, the Polish defender, had a short stint in Palermo, but that was his first foray into Serie A. That's another one that you could kind of, you know, rue the missed opportunity there to have him still under the club, or at least, you know, would have had a bigger impact than he did when he left. Some other guys, Joao Pedro, maybe not anywhere near the name recognition, but he became a very solid player for Cagliari.
Yeah.
And then you have guys who necessarily weren't from outside of Italy, but definitely made their name with the club. And this is under Zamparini's tutelage. You have a pair of World Cup winners in Luca Toni and Fabio Grosso, of course, the hero of the 2006 World Cup campaign. Others on that team, Andrea Barzagli, who Juventus fans will know, you know, very well. So, you know, there have been a lot of great players that have come through the doors in Sicily, but obviously, the way the club was being run and the way a smaller club has to be run, you know, you try to find these budding stars and then flip them for a profit so you can sustain your club.
Well said. You know, as you were talking and, you know, Zamparini's goal of the Champions League, you know, it made me think how Palermo in a lot of ways was like the southern Italian version of Udinese. Discovering players, but Udinese, the Pozzo family were, you know, definitely not as eccentric as Zamparini. So now let's talk about the new owners, because as you mentioned, this is interesting to me. There's been other times where Zamparini came close to selling the club. I know there was some groups from the U.S. that were linked, and this new group was pretty mysterious how it all happened. And the fact that you haven't released that Zamparini email yet tells me that you still have some doubt that this. So tell us a little bit about the ownership situation.
Sure. So Zamparini over the past couple of years has been facing some legal troubles. His money has been a point of contention. And, you know, despite the lack of results, he had claimed he wanted to sell the club for at least the past 4 or 5 years. Now it became real serious over the past year where there were several groups, including an American group that was close to actually closing the deal to purchase the club. And then out of nowhere, seemingly about a month and a half ago, a consortium from England came forward, and then boom, out of the blue, the papers were signed and Zamparini officially sold the club. Now, the name of this group has gone through several transformations as they continue to rename and move around the actual holding company that is responsible for this. But the three people that I guess you have to know, their names are Clive Richardson, who right now is serving as the actual president of Palermo. Emanuele Facile, who is serving as the AD right now, and obviously that's an Italian name. And then they have an advisor who keeps showing up in all this different paperwork. His name is John Treacy. So this group here has claimed to have bought the club for an honorary sum of €1. And that obviously had something to do with some of the debts that Zamparini had accumulated. But some of the uneasiness right now is all the mystery surrounding who the investors are for the actual club. This group actually made an appearance for an initial press conference about a month ago, actually 3 weeks ago, I want to say. in which they announced who they were. But if you go back and look at that press conference, there were more questions than answers. There was actually a retired English footballer, David Platt, I believe, who was at that initial press conference where Clive Richardson was as well. So it was really interesting. And like I said, still a lot of uncertainty, still a lot of doubt, because we are coming up now against some certain time periods where money does have to transfer over into the official coffers. And I think we're looking at a debt of $20 million that needs to be paid before the end of the month. And every day we're waiting for more news about where that money is or isn't, I should say. And I think the latest was yesterday there was a deposit of like $2 million. So still a drop in the bucket, still a lot of uncertainty, but it is supposed to be official. It is official in terms of the paperwork that was signed over, but obviously there's a lot more to transferring a club than just, you know, signing one document. So show me the money and then I will believe. But for the most part, this English group is continually saying, hey, give us time, patience, trust us. We are in it for the right reasons. And we are serious about this. We are going forward. It just takes time. So some uncertainty, but luckily the club is able to continue in its own right, performing very well.
Yeah, so I want to get to that. And everything you describe sounds, you know, somewhat similar to what we saw with Milan with their mysterious Chinese owners. And I always remind people, you know, calcio to people like you and me and a lot of our listeners is passion, is something that we like. But for some people, it's really more business and other things too. And I'm just going to leave it at that. But let's talk about your current Palermo, who are at the top of the standings in Serie B. They're doing really well. I saw some stats on your page. Very impressive so far. So tell our listeners a little bit what the current Palermo is like.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, David, they currently sit on top of Serie B with 37 points. That's a five-point gap over second place Brescia, who is pretty much a surprise this season, who sit on 32 points. This is the second consecutive year in Serie B. Palermo at this time last year was also sitting on top of Serie B, heading into the latter half of the campaign. And unfortunately, they didn't make it to Serie A last season. So here we are again. The club is under the guide of Roberto Stallone, who longtime Serie A fans would remember as a former striker back in the day with various clubs. He actually even coached Frosinone a couple of years ago, I think, in their stint in Serie A. But he's currently the coach. He took over for Bruno Tedino around the end of September this season. Here's a funny little story. Bruno Tedino was the head coach at the beginning of last season. He made it all the way up until the end of April, when the club was really on a poor stretch of games. He got sacked four games before the end of the season last year. Zamparini brought in Roberto Stallone, who took over for the club for the final four games and the playoff, and they lost that playoff final. Then heading into this season, what does Zamparini do? He brings back Bruno Tedino to lead the club. Tedino, for about a month, five matches, loses a game, doesn't play that well. He gets sacked, and who comes in to replace him? It's Roberto Stallone again. So history repeating itself. The good news is Stallone has done a very good job of getting this team to play an attacking brand of football, and one that really makes use of the club's strengths There aren't a lot of players that you could point to in today's version of the Rosanero that you say, oh, this guy is going to be a future star, or this kid definitely is going to find greener pastures. It's a much more practical side, essentially being led by several veterans, but also being supplemented by some players who are just being put in position to succeed. So it's been a very functional squad. The club is really strung together some great results. And in the 12 matches that Stallone has led so far this season, they have 7 wins and 5 draws. They have yet to lose. And, you know, you look at Stallone's guidance, and, you know, it is very much a byproduct of his leadership and style.
Very interesting. So you mentioned this Palermo team has no standout player, but it seems they're performing very well as a team. As you've watched Palermo, in a lot of cases, win matches against other Serie B teams, are there some players that stood out to you that you do think next season could be standout players in Serie A?
So that's really the sticking point here, and it's a concern if you are a fan of the club. You know, if this team does make the jump up to Serie A, I don't think it's like when they did so in 2013, 2014, where you had all these young talents who clearly had what it takes to perform at the next level, and that's why they were able to succeed. I think if you look at the current team, some of their best players are, you know, 28, 29, 30 years old, and not saying that that doesn't mean they can't be successful in the top flight, but many of them already have been in the top flight and, you know, are still around. You have our captain, Nestorovsky, who is a striker and essentially the pace setter of the club. He provides the leadership, he provides the goals. But is he somebody like an Andrea Belotti who you can turn around and sell? No, not quite. He's a little too old. He doesn't have that pedigree and youth on his side. Another one of the leaders this season is Mato Jajalo, who is a central midfielder, but he also is a Serie A veteran, and he's been with the club for at least 4 or 5 years. So, you know, some of the younger players currently on the team, I look at a guy like Simone Lofaso, who some people will recognize. He was with Fiorentina last season. Actually, Palermo sent him there on loan. He hasn't even seen a minute of the field yet this year, and that's been due to injuries. And now there's talks about him being loaned out for playing time. So he, I guess, will be the closest thing to some sort of starlet. He's young. Another guy, I guess you could say, George Puskas, who, if you visited my Twitter feed over the last couple weeks or so, has really made a name for himself, not in scoring goals, although he does have that to his name so far this season, but his fashion sense, as he is quite the outfitter there. So, you know, it's something that I think this new ownership group is going to have to put in terms of investment to get this club ready for Serie A. The team as is would definitely be struggling in the top flight, and they would be in another relegation battle. So we need an injection of cash, some smart buys, and I don't want to say a complete overhaul of the team, but there are enough holes that they would sink pretty quickly.
Okay, so now let's close on this topic. And there is a big connection between Padova and Palermo, so my team and yours. So there isn't a connection in the standings, unfortunately, because Palermo's at the top and Padova's dead last. But the two clubs have what's called in Italy un gemellaggio between the fan bases and, more precisely, the ultra group. So basically, there's kind of like, I don't know what the best word is, partnership, bond, friendship. So I remember a few years ago, I'm friends with a few ultras for Padova, especially one of them. You know, he told me, hey, I'm going down to Palermo all the ultras there are treating us to this visit. They took us to all the clubs, restaurant, match, and whatnot. So tell our listeners a little bit more about what a gym at Laggio is, and specifically the one between Palermo and Padova.
Certainly. So as you said, David, there isn't, you know how it is with Italian terms. Sometimes there is no right word for it in the English language. Other things I've heard with gemellaggio is twinning, but even that I don't think really gets to the concept. Another way of thinking about it is in the United States or in other cities, you see this concept called a sister city. So it's similar to that, but as you said, David, this is between the fan bases and specifically the ultra. So this friendship between the two clubs was formed 35 years ago, believe it or not. So it's a funny story. There were about five Bianco Scudati fans. So those are Padova supporters who were on a holiday in Sicily, and they actually met some Rossonero Ultras belonging to a certain group. Ultra group, I think it was the Comandos Aquile, but they became friends on this holiday. From there, on November 20th, I believe this is 1983, they essentially made it official. And over the years, there hasn't been many meetings between the two clubs on the pitch. Obviously, in 1983, I think that was the only meeting between Palermo and Padova in the 80s. They met again in the 90s, where this new generation came along and essentially solidified that relationship once again. There were some hints that, you know, there was political ramifications to why these two fan bases were able to come together. But beyond that, it was really something that goes just, you know, it's not enough to say that the politics alone were what really solidified this. But beyond that, this season was the first time that the two clubs have met in 17 years. And as a token of what this really means, so it was in Padova, at Padova, I should say, and the two groups actually met before the game and had like a barbecue. It was just another one of those things where you see it's like the exact opposite of a rivalry. That's the best way that I can describe it.
That's a fantastic description. And I think the political affiliations are just really a small part of it. It has been told to me exactly like you, like random meeting between ultra guys and they just hit it off and it turned into something. So really, really interesting stuff. So listen, Lorenzo, it was absolutely fantastic for me to chat with you. Anyone who wants to learn more about Palermo, definitely check out the Ultra Palermo Twitter account, website. You can follow it at Ultra Palermo. We're going to tweet it out on the bio when we tweet out the episode of Calcio. And Lorenzo, great guy. Follow him on Twitter, his own account as well. Not too much Calcio there, with some cool stuff at Vicini Lo. So anything else you want to promote, Lorenzo, that comes to mind, or does this cover it?
No, this pretty much covers it. I will say Serie B is a different animal than Serie A, and I don't have to tell you that, right, David? So different styles, different atmospheres even.
Yeah.
But you still have the same craziness. And even though we're without Zamparini, there is no shortage of nutcases still making their way through the realms of Italian football.
Absolutely. Well, listen, you did a great job at a great time. Thanks so much for joining me. Happy New Year and best of luck to Palermo. I don't feel bad saying it since we have a gym at Laggio. So take care.
All right, you too.